Welcome to TechEd Europe. Welcome to Spain, Madrid. My name is Ulrich Hohmann. I'm the chief architect for the Worldwide Services Consulting Organization for Microsoft. And I want to talk to you about devices and services, as Microsoft is now a devices and services company. In the intro to the slides or to the session, it says demystifying. I'm already putting the result in front. Demystified, I should have put this at the end. But I was too lazy to change it. So it was a bug that already did in New Orleans, so I carried it forward. Devices and services is one of those where our fearless leader, Mr. Balmer, stands in front of a very big crowd and says, we are now a devices and services company. And then he gets off stage and everybody's wondering, okay, what the hell does that mean now? Do we do something completely different now, or is BizTalk Server part of the device and services strategy or everything else? And so since I'm part of the consulting organization where I have about 22,000 people running around in the world, and they will serve their customers as best as possible, but if they don't get more guidance, they kind of like will make stuff up to say, okay, I think it means this. I heard somebody talk like that. And so I built a lot of this content for internal consumption, and then we talked about TechEd and said it might be a good thing to talk about this as part of TechEd, because I'm sure a lot of people are wondering, what is this devices and services stuff all about? And why does Microsoft shift pretty much its $10 billion investment for R&D into that direction? What does this really mean? And what are the possible benefits from your perspective as either partners or customers of Microsoft in this ecosystem? Why is everybody so excited? When you look at the timeline, and this is from our friends from Cisco, it actually shows that connected devices, which is really what we are interested in, not devices per se, connected devices will grow to about 50 billion in the year 2020. No idea where this number comes from. It doesn't really matter if it's going to be 45 or 60 billion. The number is ginormous. And the number actually also reflects a clear reality. We're not just talking about laptops or phones or other things with a human interface and people using it. We are talking about the Internet of Things, or the Internet where you have connected devices, machines, sensors, all these other things that we are actually starting to get really interested in as an industry and as an environment ecosystem. So when you think about devices and services, yes, a lot of the sessions here will talk about Windows 8.1 and the various devices associated with it. We will also talk about iOS and Android as device types. But there will be other things like an airplane or a fracking machine or any of these complex machineries that actually are out there that are going to be connected systems, connected devices that need to be serviced by services and so forth. So the opportunity is way, way bigger than just phones and tablets and computers. This is a picture from our friends from GE. If you haven't looked at it, they actually have published a very nice white paper on the internet about the Internet of Things, and they will talk about healthcare, they talk about aerospace, and all sorts of other things. I'm not going to go through the details here, but it will show you that all aspects of computer science, of investments in computer technologies, software, hardware, et cetera, are effectively being affected by this devices and services push. And we will see new systems emerge that will think about, how do I manage 50 billion devices? If I today think about an enterprise with 150,000 users and updating software for them, for example, that's a really big challenge. Now, if you comply and or apply math to this and put this to 50 billion devices, we have to change a lot of stuff in order to make this work. Here's some numbers, again, coming from our GE friends. And they really just give you some ideas why everybody is so excited. If you invest in a smart, connected airplane, for example, and you're able to save 1% of fuel, over a period of 15 years, you will save $30 billion just on that fuel. And again, you can see the numbers, and these are just examples of what's possible. So again, I don't know which business you're in, but I'm sure you can look at it and say, what could a devices and services world look like for me, and what are the savings or additional benefits that I can offer to my customers and my customers' customers if you are in that type of business? I hope that you have seen this architecture before, because it's not an architecture slide, but it's a marketecture slide that talks about a connected device ecosystem with continuous services. There are two key words in here. One is connected, and the other one is continuous. Connected devices, as in this world, means we are almost always connected, or at least once in a while. It does not mean that you're always connected, always on, and always connected with a great bandwidth. We'll talk about bandwidth and latency a little bit later, because that is one of the key challenges in a devices and services world. Sometimes you only have bandwidth enough to send bitwise signals up the earth because you're digging as an oil machine down thousands of meters down the earth, and you don't really have a lot of 3G 1,000 meters under the earth. So from that perspective, always think connected with a very big grain of salt. As you might hear from my name and some of my accent, I'm a German. And even in Germany, which I don't consider a non-developed world, there are areas that don't have cell phone connectivity in Germany. And so from my perspective, that will tell you that in other areas of the world, go to Siberia or in certain areas of China or India, you won't find any connectivity at all. So designing systems that require connectivity all the time, you need to think about that. And so connected means almost always connected, or at least once in a while. The other one is continuous service. We are used to services that have downtime. We are used to services where we have blackout time windows where we can do maintenance and stuff like that. We will still have to do maintenance, but we have to become way, way smarter because devices tend to be 7x24 by 365. And part of the discussion has to be, how do I design services that actually allow you to maintain parts of the system while other parts of the system are available and up and running? I was part of a working group that created a white paper called Failsafe. So if you go to the Windows Azure Document Center, you will find Failsafe as one of the white papers that talk about how do you create these kind of continuous services, how do you make them fail-safe, and so forth. Good news is the world is becoming more open. Bad news is the world is becoming more open. Because I'm sure all of you have looked at it and saying, okay, how do I write my apps these days? Is HTML5 really the answer to all the questions? Do I go native and have multiple code bases? Do I do hybrid? And I'm sure at TechEd will give you, hopefully, good advice. This is not this session. But it's certainly something where you need to think about. When you look at the Android proliferation in the world and the adoption, you have to make strategy assignment and alignments to really think about what kind of Android do you want to support. If you then go into the next wave and saying, what if it's just a little operating system that I've never heard about? How do I support something like that with my services and so forth? The other piece that we will talk quite a lot about is the social aspects. We're seeing at Microsoft and in discussions with very large customers a convergence between what people think of as social and application development. We are seeing that certain aspects of the application are actually being exposed through the social fabric and not through APIs or application forms like you would normally do. We'll give you some specific examples. And then, of course, how do you host all this? The really interesting thing is I used to talk about SOA, 2002, 2003. I had a lot of SOA talks. And at that time, we really talked a lot about modularity, business reusability, and all these other good things. I'm sure you did the same thing to justify SOA projects or sell some SOA technology. The interesting thing is that the cloud, as a mechanism, as a metaphor, has brought SOA finally to the fruition where you can actually purchase it, because it has an economic model that we talked about at that time, but we really couldn't realize. We can now do pay-as-you-go. We can now pick and choose services on Windows Azure. I want the distributed cache, I want the database, but I don't want the service bus, or I only want the service bus and the notification services in order to use it. So SOA is becoming the paradigm that how we are building these solutions around services. And again, that's certainly something that Microsoft is investing a lot of money in to enable this, not only from a technology perspective, but also from an economic perspective, because it is equally important, as we have learned with our SOA projects. I kind of mentioned this already, but it's really important to think about devices and then step back and say, okay, what kind of device am I looking at? There's lots of interesting things going on in the world of devices. Anybody using Nike Fitbit? That's not a, there's one, there's an American. No, not an American, but at least that's a popular thing in the US already, where Nike, where I thought Nike was a sports kind of vendor, they actually are now a software and devices company. They're actually offering APIs, REST-based APIs, to developers to build on top of their Fitbit empire. So you will see interesting people emerge in this devices and services context that will allow you to build on top of their infrastructure and on top integrating with their customers. And Fitbit is just one of the examples. Lego.com with their robots and their environment, they're also offering REST-based APIs now. So if you wanted to build applications that integrate into the Lego system, there is an API for that, as you will see coming as part of this world. The other piece that is to think about is the sensor world. Anybody who is thinking about devices needs to say in the same second, next second is, what are the sensors that are available to me? And what do I think about when I consume the sensor information? How does my business process or my application change behavior? Just to give you an example, we did a prototype for a security company that does home security. And normally the consultant would come in with a piece of paper and look, how many windows do I have, how many cellar windows, how many doors, and what types of doors, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Write it down, go into his office and calculate the proposal and send it back to the prospect consumer. Now we actually took a Surface device and photographed the system, and the system was smart enough to understand the size of the window and recognize the type of stuff. And while we were still in the house, effectively calculate the proposal to say, you need a bronze contract with this kind of stuff, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So we are not changing the service per se, but we are changing the interaction using the device and the capability of the device to take photos, integrate them into the business process, and change the way we behave. Because now the customer can at least electronically sign, yep, interested, this is how much it will cost, fair enough, and off you go. So there is a number of things you can do here that I'm not seeing a lot of customers really pushing yet. A lot of customers are projecting information, like they do with HTML5 or other things, but they haven't stepped back and saying, if I had the capability A, how could I change the behavior of my app? How many of you are wine drinkers? If you haven't tried the red wine here in Spain, very good stuff. Have you heard about a little app called Vivino? Somebody has already heard about it. So Vivino is a similar thing where you can actually take a photo of the label and it will send it back to a service and it will try and recognize the label and effectively build a database of the wines you drank while you're on the road or at home or whatever. And it sounds like a trivial thing. It actually is a very useful thing if you're a wine collector or you're saying, wow, I love this wine and I would love to do maybe find it when I come home. And so, again, trivial examples to a degree, but think of the devices and sensors as very much a combination to be exploited. Storage types, again, one of the things we are looking at is how much storage do you have? How much can you cache? Especially when you have latency, network latency issues, you need to have some kind of data device or data that you have local. So how do you think about that? How do you drive that kind of thing? And don't make assumptions that you have lots of storage available. You might not. If, let's say, the next generation watch comes out, which is a smart watch, Microsoft, by the way, had one of those in 2000. We just were too early, I guess. Which will come out, and then you might have no or very, very little storage. So your HTML5 solution or your native code will make assumptions. Let's say it might have an iPhone or an Android phone or a Windows phone, and all of a sudden it's running on a watch. And so the whole environment changes, and you need to think about this. So, as I said before, I have 22,000 people running around making stuff up, in the best intentions, always. So what we did as a team was pulling together with interviews across the product team. So we talked to various, up to I think 18 different product teams, from Skype to Office to Windows Server, SQL. Do you have an opinion about devices and service, and what does it mean? And we came up with these kind of principles. First of all, from the device side, devices are always connected. Again, I already talked about the almost always connected view. And this one here is important. Each device is a cache. We are not thinking about devices as persistent environments that are not replaceable, that are unique. When you do have a PC today and you're trying to update your PC, that thing has a lot of state on it that's only on that PC. Makes it very unique. A device doesn't do that. A device always puts its state in a place where it can be recreated. If you think about Windows 8, and one of the things that really pushes in the WinRT environment is for you to not keep the state local. Always replicate the data and information to some place, let's call it the cloud, that is effectively always available. The goal is to be able to say, I'm going to walk up down to the store, get one of those Surface 99 buck things, type my Microsoft identity, and all my applications, all my data flow to me. I don't have to think about this, I just do it, and based upon my identity, the store knows, the SkyDrive knows how to bring all this stuff together. And while that's a great capability, it also drives expectations back to you guys. If you are writing software, you have to think about, how do I enable this kind of behavior? Parts of it we will do, so the Microsoft Store, for example, will always flow applications to you based upon identity. But what about your state? How do you think about this? If you're writing state in your application, which you all do, how do you synchronize it? Where does it go? Where's the place in the sky, the cloud, where you can store all this stuff? Again, device state, we are thinking that you should think about applications and user state differently, not together. Again, if you look at some of the Office applications, Word, they munge it. So user state and application state is very much the same. And we think that that's not necessarily the best design. And then the transparently accessible from any device. I don't do this, but I hear that lots of people are looking at this, where they're saying, hey, I'm starting to at home on my desktop PC with my browser. I'm going on in my car, and I would like to look at the car on my phone. And then I'm going into my office and want to finish the transaction there. We are seeing some retailers, for example, where they're actually looking at enabling you to start browsing their catalog, their website, putting things into the shopping basket, and when you go to the store, you effectively check out with your iPhone or your Windows phone based upon the shopping basket being synchronized between the PC, the web browser, and the actual phone. And that's something that people will start to expect from you, from your applications, that none of this, where you access it from, where you started, and where you end the transaction matters, because it's all transparent from a device-to-device perspective. And then another piece that we believe is important, a device does not have to have a user interface. It might not. It might only respond to signals where you can send them certain commands, very simple possibly, especially if it's a complex machine, and you effectively have to think different ways of how you communicate with this. If you look at a Fitbit, it does have a user interface, but it actually is only a bunch of characters. So you can't draw complex pictures or any of this stuff, you just have to communicate in possibly different ways. So device discovery and understanding what kind of devices you are serving is very important and critical. On the plus side, we try to be a little bit whimsical and use the plus in this sense. There are three pieces that we believe are critical to think about. Connectivity. We talked already about the varying degrees of connectivity in terms of availability, but also capability. Between 3G, 4G, LTE, or 2G, there is a huge difference in terms of how much data you can push and how much data you can synchronize between the various environments. And being able to detect that you have better or different capabilities available is something that's important. I wrote down that you should just look at the Windows 8 network guidance. They actually have done an awesome job. Even if you don't want to program Windows 8, just reading through how they talk about the network guidance, and what you have to think about for example, meter connections. So I'm roaming here, obviously, in Spain, coming from the US, and I have 120 megabytes international data plan. If you use, if you're not careful and download updates from the store or stuff like that, those 120 megabytes go really, really fast. And so Windows 8 has built-in capabilities for you as application developers to determine, am I on a metered connection? And alter your behavior accordingly. And tell the user, hey, I'm going to synchronize this much data. Is that okay? Or do you want me to defer until you're on a Wi-Fi network? And so there is a lot of intelligence that has to be built into applications to really deal with connectivity. Because it is such a crucial thing, as we will see later, there's a couple of things that we also start to expect that will eat into connectivity even more. Identity, a crucial thing. I hope that you all have an identity strategy if you're an enterprise customer, and if you're a partner, that you know how to propose an identity strategy to a customer. Because without identity, the whole thing will break down. And it's all about federated identity. It's all about claims-based security. There's lots of sessions that will talk about that. But really have a have an idea of what you're thinking about when you drive down devices and services, because you need to have an identity strategy. Just one key point. A device might have an identity. It might not have. The user might have an identity. He might not have. And you need to think about, what do I do in terms of a service that wants to provide services to this device or this user if I don't have an identity? Do I have varying degrees of service capability? Do I require an identity? And so forth. If you think about bring your own device, generally speaking, the device does not have an identity that you can control. The device might have an identity in itself, but you as an enterprise administrator cannot control that device because it is not yours. It's somebody else's. You will control the user identity that is being used to access enterprise resources, but you cannot control the device. And some of the machines that we're talking about, like a fracking device or an airplane, don't really have a user identity. They just have device identity or multiple identities that you have to associate services and capabilities with. Very, very important topic. I can't stress it enough. If you take nothing away from this talk, but oh, God, I got to think about identity and federated identity strategy, I've achieved my goal. Integration, it's about data. Very simple. REST-based APIs are the winner in this game. We'll talk about specifics next slide. Notifications is something that become also very, very important, that people want to see real-time updates to things that are happening. So when you look at events in your enterprise or in your application services, they want to be distributed to the devices. And good news is that all the major device types, Apple, Google, and Microsoft, now have platform notification services built in. And even better is that the backend services, either Windows Azure mobile services or the Notification Hub technology, supports all three notification hubs without you having to write any code. You just get that support automatically from the solution. Notifications are coming in two forms. One, it comes in applications where you actually talk to the device because you don't know if the application is up and running. And you want to say, hey, you got updates from your stockbroker, or you got updates from this or that. You have seen some of the live tiles in Windows 8 where they just give you updates about stuff. And live tiles are a representation of this platform notification service for a specific app. The other type is app-to-app. So you have a two-way or two-way communication between application and a service or application to application. How many of you have heard about Signal R as a technology? Some of you. So Signal R is effectively an ASP.NET technology that we just shipped as open source. So you can download it from CodePlex and NuGet and all these other good things. And that allows you to effectively use WebRPC, so remote procedure calls, from a browser to a web server without having a dependency on the WebRPC technology, which is part of the HTML5 spec, but it's not implemented everywhere. And especially when you have older browsers or older web servers, you don't necessarily find that support. So signal R is effectively saying, if I am as an application, talk to Eduardo as a service in the back, I can actually do this in real time. I don't need a platform notification service as a broker in between. I can talk directly. And that has useful scenarios as well when I want to talk and send information to just this application without brokering through the platform notification service. I can actually do that using Signal R. So those technologies, both Azure Mobile Services Notification Hubs and Signal R, are really a key technology as part of this devices and service investment. Integration patterns, all of you that have been thinking about enterprise application integration, service buses and so forth that have application patterns on top, those are a lot very similar with the devices and services world. You just have to think about how much data can I push back and forth. So integration patterns, if you are an EAI person, will become in very handy as part of a devices and services world. Last but not least, services. I talked about Failsafe already. That is an initiative that we are driving as part of an education, but also an engineering environment where we're working with the various Azure services and teams to make them more fail-safe and provide services that allow your application to be 7x24 by 365. It's not technology alone, though, because you have to design your service to be able to take parts of the system offline for servicing while still keeping other parts of the system online. You might have to replicate your service and run multiple copies and then use rolling upgrade patterns to effectively change the way the versioning of your system, patching, and so forth. RESTful APIs. If you are still on SOAP, SOAP will live forever. I was part of the early design teams, so we were doing a lot of work based upon our design points, which was the enterprise at that time. And REST came in and really changed the picture based upon devices and services. If you think about SOAP as a technology that supports hundreds of thousands of users and so forth, now we are in the billions of users and we are in the millions of services. So that end-to-end growth in both consumers as well as providers required us to change the way we think about APIs and interaction. So if you're not yet on REST, think about it, because it's part of the overall industry change around devices and services. Let me talk about that one, Open Graph OAuth. Let's talk this. No, need to go. It's two more slides. So we will talk about the OData, Open Graph, and OAuth piece two slides from now. It's a very interesting set of APIs that if you haven't heard about them, spend time on them because they are critical to at least partially the industry, partially Microsoft. OData is currently a Microsoft protocol, although it's open source, and it's supported by SAP, IBM, and Microsoft. Those are the three big ones I know. And it's supported on any technology you want, JavaScript, C++, any of the client OSs. Open Graph is a social API that comes from our friends from Facebook, and we have implemented it already in Yammer. As our social fabric, and we will talk about use cases, why do we care? And then OAuth is something that is to do with identity, open authentication, and that is an industry standard that is effectively adopted by everybody. So if you think about devices and services, on the one side you think federated identity, and on the other side you're thinking OAuth as the API authentication for your application to application or application to services communication between environments. Now that we have some principles of how we base devices and services and how we think about what is a device role, what's the services role, and how do you integrate those two, we actually are looking at progression levels. These are not good, bad, or bad. These are simply things that we have seen customers think about when they are thinking about devices and services. Some of our marketing material, which you might have seen, talk about a modern application, which is running on a device and services fabric, is, yes, user-centric. Okay, great. It's data-centric. Okay, fantastic. It's social integrated, and those are pretty much the three that we talk about. And then there's lots of detail around, oh yeah, it should be dynamically scalable, elastic, blah, 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 all sorts of other things. But these three. The problem is exactly the Steve Ballmer scenario. They say it's user-centric, data-centric, and social. Then they walk off stage, and you're kind of saying, okay, what do I do now? And here is what we kind of put together so that you can have a frame of reference of if you are really believing that your application should be user-centric, data-centric, and social integrated, here is a roadmap of how you can think about this problem. First, the progression level zero is a simple application, primarily device-centric, that stores its data in the cloud. That's all it does. We talked about why we want to support the device replacement scenario as well as the multiple device scenario. A typical application or a great application in this scenario is OneNote. If you haven't used Office OneNote yet, it actually is available on all the device types, and it uses the cloud by default SkyDrive or SkyDrive Pro as its effective storage for synchronization. And it works actually really, really well. So very typical application, good old OneNote. This is where we have built as Microsoft Services a ton of applications, and I'm sure some of you have built applications as well, which effectively is, yes, we're building a modern application, it's touch-enabled, it's sexy, and all these other good things, and it actually stores its data in the cloud, either in a specific business service where the data is associated. So for example, we have built a lot of applications for banks. So we would have a service in the bank which effectively stores account data, user profiles, and other things. Or we have built an application for Emirates Airlines, which we use to effectively manage the airplane or the servicing of the people in the airplane while the plane is flying. So we downloaded the information, but we now bring, once the flight is over, we will send the information back. So that people say, ah, actually, these people got upgraded. This is what their wine preference was, blah, blah, blah. So that effectively the users, the flyers, can be served better the next time they enter an Emirates Airlines plane. So you will see effectively the majority of apps currently being in this one. The next one are these interesting ones from my perspective. The first, the second level is social enabled. Social enabled really means two things. On the direction from the social fabric, that's the word for Facebook or Yammer that the social people use, you effectively take the graph into your application or your service to effectively customize and personalize. So you understand what your preferences is, you understand your friends' friends, and so forth, and you effectively change the behavior of your app based upon what you find. Let me give you a trivial example. We built a devices and services solution for a food network. And what they were interested in is, are there any food preferences in that social graph? So for example, let's say I'm from Germany, so I must like pork, or I'm from Spain because there's lots of pork running around here. So let's assume I have my food preferences in pork. So what they wanted to do is have that service understand my preferences and tailor the food experiences against my preference. So that anytime I do a search, anytime I browse the website, I actually get a different, I get an optimized experience based upon my graph. If you haven't looked into graphs, that's one of the uses of these things. The second one is the push. From an application or service perspective, you're sending information into the social graph. Why would you want to do that? So you're saying, let's take a Salesforce scenario or CRM scenario. I'm getting a sales order in, and I have five people that normally work on this account. Today, I would actually have to either send an email, or I have to open the CRM application to understand, I got a sales order from this customer, where is it currently, how am I doing with my quota, what's possibly changing in that sales order, all these things. And now I can actually say in the CRM application, I would like to follow this app, this instance of a sales order. And with this follow action, I can actually get updates automatically into my social fabric, for example, Yammer. And all the people that are in this communication network, could be the customer, could be the partner, could be just the internal team, will get the updates about the sales order, Where's the sales order going? Are there any modifications of the deal, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So you're actually having the application integrate with the social fabric through follow, like, or share. Those are the three verbs that we currently as Microsoft are pushing and standardizing. So follow is news feeds. Likes can actually change the way we are looking at some of the sales order because we like the deal approval scenario. So we like the change of the deal structure, et cetera, et cetera. So we are seeing a lot of interest in how does this work for my application? How would I use the social fabric to make sure that everybody who needs to know about this specific thing, let's call it the sales order, for example, is immediately updated and understands the context of what's going on. Instead of me having to open an app, find out what's going on, and so forth. So we're seeing a lot of people being interested in the consumption of the graph and the integration into the social fabric. The next one is a pet peeve of mine, which is the knowledge-driven or insight-driven application. And the insight effectively says, I want to be able to drive specific behavior when I learn something new. Let me give you an example. MSN.com is not very known or popular in Europe, but very popular as a web portal in the US and in certain countries in Southern America and so forth. They actually use the insight to understand what the navigation patterns and query patterns are. So they don't know it's me navigating and they don't track me as a person, but they track a certain set of behaviors while I'm on the site. And they have a database where they look at all these behaviors and say, if you navigated from the main page to the sports page to the American football page, you must be, or most likely, you will be white between 35 and 45 and male. And they send that demographic information back to the application, in this case, MSN.com, and saying, hey, you have one of those currently browsing your website. And in this case, the application scenario is advertising. So we're changing the advertising pattern based upon this demographic pattern to switch to whatever, shaving cream, BMWs, whatever is interesting at this point in time for that specific example. And if you have a different navigation pattern, we switch the advertising to something different. So that's one example of an insight-driven application. Another application that we have built together with a couple of oil and gas companies is what I call a command and control system, where you effectively have a very, very expensive machine, let's call it an offshore drilling platform, and you're collecting a heck of a lot of data from sensors. But you really don't know where am I right now in terms of is this, let's say, probe about to die because it's going to hit granite or it's heating up too much or whatever the conditions might be. So what we did with those guys is we collected these events, put them into a Hadoop environment and started to see, oh, when we see these five things coming together, then we know we have to stop the probe because it's about to break. For them, in this case, a very cheap probe per se, but it's important for the drilling process. It is very, very cheap for them to stop, but once it's broken, it's really hard to pull it out, put it back in, and it's very expensive. So what these guys are interested in is figuring out, A, what are the danger signs of losing certain things, and then be able to stop before it happens. And that's really what these guys are interested in. So if you think about the insight, you as an application need to provide information so that some data warehouse, data mining, big data environment can start to say, what is the correlation? When I see this, this, and this, then it means that. So effectively, you're starting to get information, mine it, understand it, link it to various events, and then you come back and say, here's a real-time model of what I'm looking for. So you're combining telemetry, meaning sending information, big data, and then you come back on the consuming side and effectively have a real-time analytics pattern where you will drive a certain set of analytics, for example, the command and control pattern. There's information patterns, like I'm sure we will see a car connected soon where it says, you know what, I sense, or maybe you gave it in, you entered it, where your driving pattern, normally you want to fast and you want to go the shortest way when you go the navigation system. Maybe you want to actually go on vacation, you have your family in your car, and you want the safest route. And you actually get the safest route from the navigation system, and then there might be events coming in like cold fronts or a sudden stop. What did I see in Germany? They actually had the pieces of the road fall off because it was so hot. And one motorcycle driver died, unfortunately, while he hit one of those things and flew off God knows where. So it would be really cool if the navigation system would be able to consume events in real time and then say, ooh, slow down, be careful, or suggest a detour around those kind of things. So when I think about insight, I think about these kind of scenarios where you combine telemetry, meaning you as an app have to tell the insight platform what you're doing, the insight platform effectively trying to understand what you're doing, and then you're providing insight back into the application, which then changes behavior based upon certain knowledge. And that's effectively our interpretation of user-centric, sexy app, touch, that kind of thing. Data-centric, really this thing. And then social, which is this thing. So that you as an app and service designer start to think about how do I integrate with these things. If you are more of an enterprise architect and chief architect person, I had an interesting one with one of the big insurance companies where the chief architect and I had a chat and he said, yep, I'm now responsible for all middleware at this company. I said, okay. And we walked through this, and he said, I can now think about it. It's either as a power play, so I can take over the social fabric and the BI platform or the insight platform, or he was more inclined to collaborate. He said, I need to talk to these people because I need to understand how can I leverage the social fabric for the application scenarios that I'm currently thinking about. How do I leverage the BI investments, the big data investments, for my applications to become smarter and offer better service. We talked about these three already, just as a very graphical picture. OData, if you ever have used JSON raw, I call it, meaning parsing JSON by hand, you will appreciate OData a lot. OData is all about metadata on top of REST. REST-based APIs are beautiful and very easy, but JSON and consuming those things is not very, very, very easy if you're a developer. OData effectively puts metadata on some of these structures so that you as a developer don't have to parse this stuff anymore. The toolkits, jQuery, .NET, Java, PHP, Ruby, and all these guys can now consume that data natively, and you as a developer just program against objects like you're used to when you're a .NET person. So it's simply a convenience thing. It also allows standard applications to consume your data. So Excel, for example, supports OData. So you can have a REST-based service that exports OData, and a customer can point Excel at it and grab the data without you having to program, having to think about, oh, Excel might come. What do I have to do for Excel? Well, you just support OData, and then Excel can support it, SharePoint can support it, SAP can support it. SAP could consume data from your service or the other way around because SAP, WebSphere, and so forth support OData. Talked about OAuth. OAuth comes together with another thing. If you have not heard about JWT, JSON Web Token, that's effectively is the encoding token for the specific authentication information in an OAuth call. So if you are looking at building those kind of APIs, OData 2.0 and JWT are two keywords that you should look up using Bing or Google or any of the favorite search engines because it is a combo that combines these two. And then Open Graph, again, started as Facebook, now available as part of Yammer, and you can see, or you will see some announcement later on. I don't know when they are going to come out of the closets for other Microsoft products to support Open Graph as well. And you can guess where it is, but I can't tell you at this point in time. I have to shoot you or myself, depending on how it works. Now let's go talk a little about scenarios. I gave you a whole bunch of examples already, but here is the conversations we are currently having in our enterprise briefing center or if I'm traveling the world. Firmware software delivery. So now you have smart TVs everywhere, and how do you get software updates to them? You can't have System Center running everywhere. It would be nice, but that ain't gonna work. So as a consumer electronics company, how do you bring updates to the software? Again, if you are Sony, maybe you have enough money and power to build your own cloud, but otherwise, how do you do that? If you are a machine producer and you have a smart machine, but it's distributed all over the globe with very poor network connectivity, you have the choice of building your own IT capability or leverage cloud scenarios where you can bring down the firmware using notifications and you can pull from a FTP site, this kind of thing. So we are seeing a lot of people looking at that as one of the scenarios. Insight delivery, all of you have used Insight without you knowing it. Maybe you have known it, but not necessarily been quite as clear about it. Amazon is the number one Insight company. It's frightening what these guys know about you. When you have purchased hundreds of books, as I have, and unfortunately or fortunately, I gave my daughter access to my Amazon account, and all of a sudden I get the skinny jeans diet recommendations because she bought something similar. And so, again, the tuning of those recommendations is certainly one of those to keep thinking about. But Amazon is clearly one of those. If you are a LinkedIn user, LinkedIn is becoming fairly aggressive, pushing insight into you. You might be interested in this job. Here are the people that you might be interested in to connect, et cetera, et cetera. And they do that based upon analysis of your network that you have already established inside LinkedIn, and so forth and so forth. Remote management, if you have seen this guy, this is a Nest device. Something that is very popular in the US, where you effectively put it into your home, and it's able to control the entire central heating system and cooling system. We built a solution together with Daimler to manage the smart device, the eSmart. So it's a cloud-based service and an application where you can effectively see how much range you have, because that is a problem with the e-cars, or at least used to be, and so forth and so forth. So we see a heck of a lot of scenarios where people are looking at how do I remote manage. I've seen a ton of advertising for the Nissan Leaf. Have you seen it in the airports? Where wouldn't it be nice, or what if your phone charges your car? That's kind of this scenario where they're looking at how do I integrate with the grid? And once the car is hooked up, you can remotely manage how you effectively charge that car. Device to infrastructure. Sounds like an interesting scenario for us in the developed world, or given that I've seen some blackouts even in the US and Europe, might actually also be interesting. But we have a very concrete scenario in Vietnam. So Vietnam is very hot and very sticky. If you have never been there, it's worth a trip, but be very lightly clothed because it is humid. It's really humid. And now good news is these guys are making more money, and so they have air conditioning, which is fantastic. Problem is, if they all turn the air conditioning on to the temperature that they like, the grid will go down. And so what now the grid guys are thinking about is to build smart grids that actually look at the consumption at this point in time and automatically interact with the AC device to bring up the temperature of the AC so that everybody has some relief instead of nobody. And so this is something that we are seeing where the infrastructure, the grid in this case, will start to interact with, for example, ACs and other things. And again, devices and services does not mean an iPhone or a Windows phone. This is actually a very, very attractive and interesting scenario that a lot of people need help with. So, opportunity. Geo-tracking, I don't think I need to talk about that. There are some very interesting consumer scenarios. The Fitbit guys do a very good job with that kind of stuff where they actually show you where you ran. You can share this with your buddies. I don't know why I would do that, but that seems to be important and those kind of things. So from that perspective, that's going on. This scenario, if you ever go to Manhattan, just behave. Be nice. Just don't do anything. If you go to London, you guys know that London is the most filmed city in the world. You are all movie stars if you've ever been to London, because there is not a centimeter of that town that isn't being filmed all day, 7 by 24. We build solutions for New York where we can now take a look at your license plate and we can follow it throughout Manhattan. And we can, again, through insights, enable if we have seen this driving pattern before and possibly look at maybe sending a police cruiser down your way because you will do something, whatever, in that kind of fashion. So we see this predictive stuff coming to bear using combination of geo-tracking and devices and insights. So how many of you remember this Tom Cruise movie, Premonition? We don't have mediums sitting in some salt water or whatever they were sitting in. We actually have big data and insights where we're actually looking at can we predict what you are doing based upon your behavior patterns of the past. So that's effectively what's going on. Media delivery and playback. If you're a Netflix user, most likely not because this is Europe, Netflix really, really angers me because I am a licensed user and I can't watch it because they're looking at geo-tracking and saying, nope, you're in Spain right now. I don't know if you're a legitimate user, so I have to do crazy stuff to effectively tell them, no, I'm not in Spain, Netflix, don't worry, don't look at the hand kind of thing. But it works really well based upon what's going on. We talked about Fitbit already. There is a ton of stuff in health going on. If you are in that business, devices and services are your playground, especially when you think about combining insight and the specific symptoms of a user, saying, uh-oh, I've seen when you have this heart spike, we have seen this kind of behavior in your age bracket, you should call, do something, get a message, and so forth. Again, here you can see how you can put real-time notifications and real-time data plus insight together to help people become either healthier or avoid problems in terms of how do you, you might go into a stroke right now. Maybe you want to slow down or something like that. And again, there are very, very classic signals that if we were more device connected, you could discover. Connected operations, mentioned that before. So again, the remote scenario and this scenario is very similar. Except that, for example, in GM, our General Motors friends have had OnStar for quite some time as a service. Used to run on 2G, will be upgraded sometime soon. And it effectively is a two-way interchange between the car and an operator. The operator is, of course, supported by software, and it sends information about your car to that operator. And, of course, they want to do insight-enabled, real-time, and so forth to say, hey, your engine is running hot. Do something. So the first step would be you as a user have to do something. Over time, with your user's permission, I can easily see that a system like OnStar could actually regulate the car's temperature on your behalf by slowing you down, saying, no, you're braking the car right now. Slow down. Again, all opt-in, so privacy is important to all these scenarios, but if the user perceives value, they generally do sign in. So think about connected operations. These kind of complex machines, if you are building these kind of things, you will start to think about connecting that complex system to a set of services that monitor, that service, and provide effectively help to the consumer of that machine to say, hey, you should do something like this. You should maintain this part because it's going to break. There is a $5 part, I don't know what it is, I think it's an air filter, that actually breaks this $40 million fracking machine. And it's out of commission for a long time. So what they're trying to figure out is how do I make sure that that air filter is still functional so that I don't stop this machine. So that kind of scenario. Connected vehicles, we talked already about. And then connected retail. Again, sounds like Big Brother. But there are stores in the US, for example, in New York, where you can register your cell phone with an ID. And they will actually track you while you're in the store. So you combine geolocation with the retail scenario. And what they're doing is they are saying, you're standing in front of the shelf for quite some time. Let me help you make up your mind. And they send you a coupon for that specific product that's on that shelf. And so they're trying to convert browsing, meaning running through the store looking at things, to purchase by helping you along with these kind of coupons. And again, it's an opt-in scenario. So it's certainly not something that they do based upon some hidden things. They actually just want to help you shop better in their store. So those are the key set of scenarios, and all of those are real. And there's lots and lots and other discussions going on, connected buses, where they want to connect each individual seat to a cloud to provide better service to that user of that seat. Airplanes, once they have more data connection up there, and that's coming soon, they will actually connect both the telemetry side of the airplane as well as the user side of the airplane to provide you better services, and on and on and on. So we talked about these already. The reason why I'm bringing this up is because I'm going to go deeper into this one, just a quick through. So telemetry, we need to collect information, we need to analyze that information, and we need to consume that information. And the key thing is instrument the application. We have said this before, as Microsoft, as the industry, your applications are the problem, meaning they don't talk to the infrastructure, they don't tell us what they do. And most application developers ignored us because they said, oh, it's no value to me, I need to provide functional enhancements and not help you ops people. That's changing because of the cloud and the paradigm of automated management. But this here is actually application behavior. We want you to tell us what the business user of your app is doing so that you effectively can provide better service. Again, the retail example and a whole bunch of other scenarios that I can think of that you can drive. Then you need to deliver events to an analytics service so that that effectively can start consuming this information and make a hypothesis, validate those hypotheses, and then effectively bring the information back. Lots of scenarios there. For example, we did it for NBC for the Olympics, where we had a media player and the media server, and we were tracking if there was jitter on the line in real time, and we were adjusting the transportation rate of the bits based upon the consumption rate of the browser. In real time, we had an information loop going back and forth where the web server and the browser effectively were coordinating their consumption and delivery patterns. And again, a very, very smooth experience for the user. They didn't see anything, and certainly something to think about. Real-time and historical analysis, again, combining real-time analytics and big data, for example. If you haven't looked at real-time analytics, technologies to explore are two. One is .NET RX, which is the reactive extensions to .NET, which are real-time extensions if you want to build embedded real-time logic in your code. It's also available for JavaScript and other languages. And you can also have Stream Insight, which is part of SQL Server. So if you have a SQL Server license, you have a complex event processing real-time analytics engine built in. And you can use that as a service to effectively build these kind of applications. This consumption format is currently driven to the user so that a business user can analyze what's going on and so forth. You have to think about these kind of four levels for telemetry, infrastructure, application. We will do that mostly for you. If you go to this Windows Azure site, they will actually talk to you about what are good collection devices, collection technologies for events, and so forth. And these are the two that you need to build. If you are building apps, we don't know what your business activities are and what that means. Is it important that you track the navigation patterns, or that you track queries that the user typed in, or that you track activity like the user put a product into the shopping basket and they pulled it back up after 2 seconds? Or actually, they pulled it into the shopping basket, then they started navigating, and after they navigated these three pages, they pulled it back out. Might not be relevant at all, but it's certainly something that you would want to track in order to improve your browsing to transaction closure ratio, which, as most of you know, if you're in e-commerce, is very, very bad. Between 2 and 5% transaction conversion rate is what's happening. And you can look at it from a user or business perspective. We have built websites where we look at the individual shopping basket, but we also look at the shopping basket across the site, saying what are people putting into their baskets, what's being converted, what is not being converted, can I do a real-time promotion? while I see people pulling things out, if I put an advertising in front of them that says, the thing that you just pulled out again is now cheaper, or we give you free shipping, will they go back and put it in? So those are some of the things you're looking at when you're driving this kind of telemetry. Now you need to look into, how do you want to drive this? Remember the connectivity discussion? Now you actually have a race between the data you want to save, like your entity data, you took orders, you took claims, whatever the thing is you take, and the information about the behavior. And those are two information streams that are separated from each other, but still it's your app or your service that produces them. And now you need to transport them. Do you put them effectively as a batch up there when the user is connected to Wi-Fi? And you don't do this at all when the user is connected at a very poor network, and so forth. Sources of signals, we already talked about that. Again, there is a whole bunch of technology available to help you with this. If you have never heard about event tracing for Windows, that's a technology that's available in Windows that does about 50,000 writes and reads per second. So it's a very, very fast in-memory cache effectively for events. The Windows Blue guys will talk about a new event infrastructure in Windows that's coming. I think they will start tomorrow talking about this. I don't think they will talk about it here, but at Build. And we also have AviCode and other technologies that really help you providing the low-level infrastructure signals, and you can focus on the high-level technology, the business and user scenarios. What are you consuming? You're informing the application, you're reacting to things, and you're exploring what could be interesting, either on the infrastructure monitoring side or on the higher-level business and user side, where you're saying, this is what happened. And if I change my strategy to do this, let's see what's going on. All of you have heard about A-B experimentation, I assume. So if you haven't, Bing A/B experiments. So when you look at Bing, Google, any of these big services, they run experiments where they actually, for Bing I know, we actually run 10% of the users get to see different user interfaces and behaviors at any given point in time. Where we randomly select, let's say you, will get a different feature, and we think we will collect how we react to it. Do you like it? Do you use it? Did you click on it? And so forth. And other people will see the same feature but differently presented, for example, and maybe that works. There's a fascinating case study about how Obama used this pattern to win the last election. He did A-B testing on letters he wanted to send to his audience. And he effectively sent different versions of the letters to representative groups. And based upon what he got back, he said, okay, that's the one we're going to send to the broader public. And he had a very, very high approval rates for the communication that he sent to the people because he did this A-B testing to figure out what the people like. So this whole crowdsourcing thing is effectively taking off in this kind of pattern. This is the pattern we have been talking about, just in case, as a visualization. So you monitor and collect events, you mine the system events or any events to produce a model, and you're effectively using an event engine, real-time analytics, to go and understand what's happening in real time and possibly modify the behavior. And that's really what's happening when you think about big data. That's what's behind that big data pattern. You dump everything you put into this digital shoebox. You don't throw anything away. Then you analyze it, try to figure out what has happened. Are there any correlations? And there are correlations that come from your information sources, and then there's correlation that comes from the outside. Weather information, oil prices, gold prices, whatever the things might be that are relevant for your scenario, put them into the shoebox, run them through a model, through machine learning, MapReduce code, whatever you do, and then say, my hypothesis is this, my data supports it, and hence I'm going to change the behavior of the website in this certain ways. Now, I talked about the telemetry from the application to the user consumer. Now I'm talking the other way around, saying from the user, I now would like to come up with strategies of how I have my application consume insight. Because when you design an app or a service and you have not designed it to consume insight, guess what? It won't. If you don't emit information, there's nothing that the app or the insight platform can do to help you. But if you now have emitted information, but you're not open for changes, I would have to rewrite the app to change the behavior. So these are some ideas of how you can effectively do that. So forget this data piece. We're running out of time, but let's do this one. We have identified three common patterns of what people do when they think about insight or knowledge-driven apps. The first one is information. Like the demographic model I mentioned on MSN, or the weather pattern changes, or the traffic behavior, or any of these other things, those are just information events that I'm sending to the app, and the app says, okay, I'll do something with it, or I don't. MSN will change the advertising pattern. The smart navigation system will recalculate the route based upon external events. Again, in Europe, you'll see this already with traffic warnings, but what other events could you put in to provide you with a better route, and so forth. And I'm sure there's lots of stuff you can do where you can inform the user, hey, Greece has just issued a euro crisis warning. You are exposed in Greek, in euros. You might want to think about hedging strategies for euros. If I'm in the online banking app, that would be nice if that thing would have told me that I might have wanted to do something with the euro before it crashes, and stuff like that. So just let your mind roam free. It is very, very easy to come up with scenarios. Command and control, mentioned this before, stop. You are about to die. Or as a user in a health scenario, don't run so fast. Your heart rate is going too high, or your blood pressure is too high, or whatever the scenarios might be. And then enhanced data. That's one of my favorites. I don't know if you've played around with SharePoint 2013, the search environment. It actually has its own MapReduce insight system built in. It has a closed loop monitor, mine, and manage pattern, where actually all search events can be put into this analytics environment. And it will use what's called as collaborative filtering algorithm to effectively drive associations between users and items. So the common thing is what our friends from Amazon do. Users bought this book, bought a similar book, and so you can associate to the user. So you go from user to item, from item to item, and from item to user. And so you can create this chain of information where I can recommend certain things to you. Products, or in the case of SharePoint, I can recommend documents to you. I can recommend anything that's inside SharePoint to you. Follow this site. People that have done this do that. So that's a new type of data called recommendations, which is entirely based upon user behavior and in correlation to information that's already in the system. The second type is enhanced data. So if you're in the knowledge management business, you might have seen this best bets. So if you go to any search website, they will tell you this is the best bet. Well, most of the best bets are actually driven by humans because they have an agenda. They want you to use this one. They think that's the best. SharePoint 2013 has a mode that you can enable that says, yes, sure, we will show your best bet, but we will dynamically adjust the position in the result set. And let's see if the users really click on it. And so they actually can rewrite the index of their own information based upon user usage of their search information. So the relevance queries will be actually changed based upon insight platform. So that's something that we have built as part of SharePoint 2013, and it's a closed loop system that works, if you wanted to, automatically across the relevance and the collaborative filtering scheme. So recommendations and new information, for example, is a very common scheme that we are seeing. The social stuff, if you haven't played much with social, this is a taxonomy. I'm not claiming that it's the taxonomy, but it's a taxonomy of what the various social pieces are. And generally, I divide social into the demand chain and into the supply chain. The demand chain is effectively your consumers and your business partners that drive demand for your products or services. And for them, you're trying to figure out how to advertise to them without calling it advertising. and how you effectively drive behavior so that they think positive about you. On the supply side, you think about employees and your suppliers. And you effectively are trying to make them more effective. You're trying to help them be on the ball and help the customer saying, oh, there is a customer that talks badly about our new product. What can we do to find out? You, go and figure it out. Go and talk to this customer, either integrating with CRM or with other technologies that you already built in. There's lots and lots of good data out in the internet. If you haven't played with that as an application developer, as an enterprise person, time to go. It really is becoming important. Again, we talked already about the adapting the experience effectively. Based upon your friends and your friends' friends and your preferences, it will change. If you have not used Bing, change your country to the US, and you get the US search engine, which is really awesome. The European ones still have work to do, let's call it that. But the US Bing engine is really cool. And one of the things you can do is actually you can log into Facebook, and the search algorithm will filter your experiences and your friends' experiences into it, saying you're looking for a movie, and you're typing in whatever, The Man of Steel, which is being advertised all over the place in Madrid right now. And some of your friends have already seen it. The search engine will actually filter its result based upon your friends' preferences and opinions. So those are some of the things that we are doing ourselves with this knowledge-driven and social-enabled application. Open Graph is effectively RDFA, if you are interested in technology, not that important. We suggest not to invent new social verbs, if you can, but focus on the share, follow, like, and really determine meaning from your application perspective for those verbs or nouns, depending on where you come from. And so that's something that we need to look at. So when you look at this, is devices and services really drive across the entire spectrum of how we think about software. And the word middleware, which used to think about compilers and queues and databases and stuff like that, now include the social fabric and include the insight platform. So if you're not really into that kind of stuff yet, and you're very focused on your building functionality, this is about to change because people are looking at the modern application experience with the eyes that I kind of hopefully shown on this for you. Good news is, it's exciting, meaning the world is really changing to this connected world, and connection means also that we can do interesting things. When our friends from Nike first came out with this shoe where they actually recorded all the information, nobody really thought that that was that interesting. At least I didn't think so. But now when you think how they turned it into Fitbit and that entire ecosystem of how they got people to build applications on top of their infrastructure and adding value to the information that they are giving those apps, or you as a user giving those apps actually, it's really, really interesting what you can do. Any discussion I'm having right now with customers, they're saying, I have this thing, I would like to connect this projector. What do I do? What are the scenarios? What can I help? And most of this is about maintenance at the first case and then added value. How can I add value to the experience? Because as we all know, prices and product per se is only one half of the equation these days. Interaction with the user, doing more things than the other guy is going to change the way we're thinking about this. REST, OAuth, and OData are critical components. If you look at any of the Microsoft services, be they on Windows Azure or Office 365 or the products that make up these services, they all support OAuth now, and they all support OData. And a subset where it's relevant will support Open Graph as a thing. And the other piece that you are hopefully getting from Microsoft these days is that it's not just about Windows. Yes, Windows is critical to Microsoft, and we will make sure that the experience on Windows is the best and the easiest for you as developers, administrators, and so forth. But iOS and Android are critical components as well, and stuff that doesn't run any of those three, because embedded systems and systems that just have tiny devices might not even run really an OS. And so think about the world of devices and services bigger than QuadraQuant just phones, tablets, pads, and desktops. I don't know why we have to put this in, but it is part of the deal, blah, blah. You know the various resources you can use. You can revisit all this content. The content will be made available as part of Channel 9. If you wanted to use the slides, I saw some photographs. If you want to have the slides, I can also send them to you. That's all fine. I'll scan this to evaluate the session. I appreciate any feedback you have, any thought in terms of how could we make this better for you. This is a very rich set of complex thought. And part of what I do when I present internally is this is the lead-in session, and then we have 10 sessions go deeping in each of these because each of these deserve to be looked at in depth as part of a conversation. With that, I am precisely at 0.00. That means I can't really take questions anymore except if you have some urgent things on your mind. Otherwise, I'll stick around. If you want to have a discussion and ask some questions, I'm more than happy to answer them. Thank you very much for your patience and attention. Thank you, and enjoy Madrid.